Hey guys, this is Present Day John tuning in. As you might already be aware of if you listen to my updates episode, now that I'm back from break, I can finally start recording business as usual. So you might notice that I'm doing things a little out of order, but this episode's going to be the Promised Neverland Part 2 episode, finally, after so many delays. It was recorded in December, actually, so... If you didn't listen to my updates episode, I did have some free time during the month of December, and there was a point where I finally got caught up to the series, and I figured, you know what, while this information is still fresh in my mind, I'm going to record an episode on it. And that's what I ended up doing. And I didn't post it right away. I wanted it to be sort of like a pre-Christmas surprise to you guys. Like, even though I said I was on break, I was like, you know, I actually had time to record this, so now I could finally release something for you guys, you know, while you're waiting for me to come back. And I didn't ever... upload it, and I was like, oh, maybe it's because I said I was going to listen to it again just to make sure it was okay. And now I remember why I didn't upload it. So for one, my dog Daisy, she had another guest spot on the podcast. That's funny because it's kind of like a continuation of when I first introduced The Promised Neverland. Daisy also was barking in the background in that episode, and I just kind of kept it there because I was on a roll talking, and I was like, you know, I don't want to repeat any of this, and I feel like I made some good points, so I left her barking in the background in there. But as much as it drives me crazy to have her barking in the background, I really hate that. It's not the best listening experience. I mean, it wasn't super loud, but you know, you could hear her in the background. I recorded in a separate room so that you guys didn't have to witness the full intensity of her bark, because it is terrifying, and so much so that even if I'm in a room across the apartment, she still is loud enough to reverberate through the walls and the doors. So she did start barking again, and this recording, well, again, it's not extremely loud, but it was annoying, and I'm sorry. I don't want to have to record that section again. I just want to release this episode to you guys, so that's what's going on. I think that's why I didn't release it right away, because I was contemplating re-recording those segments, and then I just never did, because as soon as that free time came is as soon as it left, because then things got a little busy when my grandma came up from Georgia to spend the holiday with us. So I didn't have time to re-record it anyways. And also, I realized I didn't finish recording that episode. I recorded almost the entirety of it, and then I just left off the ending. So you're going to see present day me tune back in at towards the end of the episode, just to cap off the episode. Close out everything. But I'm sorry guys, so a little bit of technical difficulties. Daisy is guest spotting again in this episode, so everyone give your regards to Daisy. She loves to bark at just the most random inopportune times, over almost nothing sometimes. You'd think we've been living in this apartment for a couple of years now, and you'd think she'd get used to just the cars pulling in and out in the parking lot, so on and so forth, but nope. She just has to let everyone know she lives here, and please don't come near my door. So with that all said, also just a correction from the update episode. I misspoke twice in a row. I'm like, I don't know what I was thinking. I said I was going to be releasing three episodes a week. No, not three episodes a week. It's three episodes a month. Three introduction episodes a month. That fourth week is a follow-up episode akin to this. Did I use that properly? But yeah, that fourth week is a follow-up episode, a part two episode, if you will. So I said, oh yeah, I'm going to be recording three episodes a week. In an effort to save myself some time, I'll be recording three episodes a week. And that fourth, it didn't make any sense. So I apologize if you were listening to that updates episode and you're like, wow, he misspoke twice. Did he really mean three episodes a week? No. Three introduction episodes a week in the style that I've been doing them in, you know, the manga introduction episodes. And then that fourth week is a part two episode, a follow-up episode to a previously introduced series. In this case, it's Promised Neverland, which everything's all out of whack because it's the first week of January and I'm recording this now. And I was originally going to do Land of the Lustrous or Inuyashiki. I can't remember which one was supposed to come first. It's just like I'm all over the place in terms of the schedule. So I hope you guys can just bear with me. Thank you for your patience. That's the format moving forward. Spoiler minimal manga series introduction episodes, weeks 1 through 3. And then spoiler heavy series follow-up episodes, week 4. Because the workload, reading that much material... in that last week of the month was just too much. Having to read for that week's material and then read for the follow-up bonus episode material. It's just, I'm a slow reader. I don't know if you guys realize this, but like, I try to cover like at least like 3 volumes for the series that I introduce on the show. I want to cover at least 3 volumes. I think that's a decent chunk of material and allows me to, you know, especially for a series that may not have a lot of substance to them, the first volume or two, it's nice to have a decent chunk of material to work with for those episodes. And I think for the follow-up episodes, I'm probably, they're not going to be as big of a gap between the amount of manga that I covered in the introduction episode and the amount of manga that I covered in the follow-up episode. So in the case of Promised Neverland, I think I covered like the first, when I had introduced the series, you know, a while ago, I had read like the first 6 volumes. And now that I'm doing this follow-up episodes, it's been like 6 volumes later, really. I'm going up to like volume 12. So it's probably not going to be every 6 volumes in a series. So for instance, like Yone of the Dawn, if I read the first 3 volumes, I think for this follow-up episode, I'm going to read the next 3 or 4 volumes. And then I'm sure I'm going to do a part 3 and a part 4. Basically, the idea is that I'll consistently return back to these series, not in consecutive months. So it's not going to be like, okay, this month is Promised Neverland Part 2, and then Yone of the Dawn Part 2, and then Promised Neverland Part 3. Like, I'm going to give other series a chance because I want to return to several series. And then, but like towards the end of the year, I might, you know, move right back up to Promised Neverland, especially because that gives time for volume releases too. I want at least 3 more volumes to come out before I cover Promised Neverland again after this. So, in this case, I'm covering up to volume 12. In the next episode, it'll probably be volume 13, 14, 15, 16, volume 16 or so. Yeah. So, anyways, that does it. enjoy the episode. It's going to be kind of like an awkward introduction because I cut out the previous introduction in favor of this one, so I can interject and let you guys know that this is technically me recording in December. So it might be a little bit of an awkward start to the episode, but things start to get flowing, and I think I had some pretty good impressions on what I've read so far now that I'm caught up. So I hope you guys enjoy. And yeah, just a reminder, this is filled with spoilers. These follow-up episodes are going to be filled with spoilers. So if you're not caught up to, I think, Volume 12, The Promised Neverland, then I would suggest not listening to it unless you're okay with spoilers and you just want to hear me talk about what I thought. Enjoy. Now I could actually get to the meat of this episode. So this is, again, a two-parter, or a follow-up, a part two to The Promised Neverland that I covered in episode 4. This is unlike my normal episodes where they're just like minimal spoilers, just introducing the author and the general impressions of the series. Now I'm going to be talking more maybe from like a storytelling perspective, things that I enjoyed, didn't like so much, just more detailed impressions, and just covering a lot of the story, just heavy spoilers, basically up until, for this episode, which I'll also include in the show notes, it's going to be up until the end of volume 12 or chapter 106, which I can't remember if I said that earlier, but I'm saying it again just to reiterate. So if you haven't caught up to that, basically it's like right after Goldie Pond, that arc. It's after Goldie Pond, shortly after Goldie Pond. And I don't know how much I want to say just in case you're not there. But yeah, basically like shortly after Goldie Pond, the arc is over. You know when that arc is over because it's a pretty definitive end to that arc. So that's going to be covering up until that. So, man, The Promised Neverland, where do I begin? I was really high on this series when I first introduced it on the show. It was a series that I just started binging. And I think when I had started it on the podcast, I had read like 6 or 7 volumes at that point. And that basically covered most of the stuff that was going on in the orphanage, I believe. And I don't know, I don't think I touched on like the aftermath of the orphanage because I wasn't trying to get into like spoilers or anything. I didn't even mention the fact that there's demons. I think I did a pretty decent job about talking about what was good about the series without spoiling the whole like central conceit, like the whole fact that these kids are being bred to be served as food for demons. I did a pretty good job of like avoiding that explicitly. So I recommend, hey, if like you guys are, at this point, I'm assuming you guys are okay with me spoiling things, by the way. So if you guys are, current or whatever in The Promised Neverland, and you're trying to get friends introduced, I would definitely shoot them that episode, because I think that's a good spoiler-free introduction without giving away what happens at the end of the, you know, that first reveal. I think it's a pretty nice way to get them kind of pique their interest in the series without giving away any major spoilers, other than there's something fishy going on in this orphanage, right? But yeah, so I think, I'm not sure where I want to start. So I complimented the series originally with how it really reminded me of Death Note in a way that it's different from the standard fare that you see appear in Shonen Jump. It's less action heavy and more, you know, you're trying to outwit the enemy, and there's lots of like cat and mouse tactics, and it relies heavily on like cliffhangers and plot twists and stuff like that. It's not really an action manga. There's not even like a lot of like, you know, a lot of these shonen series have like comedy and romance and just a hodgepodge of a bunch of things, but their main focus is like action and going on an adventure and, you know, and getting stronger and stuff like that. This is very different compared to those types of series. And, but like the core, I think, like Shonen Jump values, I guess, are still present in this manga. Just that whole idyllic philosophy. It's like, well, we can, you know, we can, if we're together, we can get through this. I'm not gonna let anyone die. We're all gonna make it out together. We just have to figure this out and push through this just through like sheer force of will, you know, that kind of thing. That's still present, especially in like an Emma's character who's very idyllic. Idyllic, is that the right word? I don't even know if I'm using that word properly. But she's very, she always sees the good in things. She kind of makes like these really lofty, just like claims that, you know, I'm gonna get everyone out here no matter what, you know, no one else is dying on my watch, that kind of thing. And you know, these very just like really strong claims, like, are you gonna be able to back that up, Emma, because you're in a really dangerous situation. Like, yeah, no, you don't want your family to die, but she's not, I don't think she's much of a realist. When you see what she's surrounded with, it's just kind of crazy how she can maintain that attitude throughout the series. But yeah, so a lot of that cat and mouse and stuff, that kind of goes away, because once they leave the orphanage, it suddenly becomes more of a survival thing, more of a, there's definitely more action, especially when you get to the Goldiepun arc. And the manga just feels different. It's really weird. The demons were initially just shrouded in mystery. And again, there was a lot of that cat and mouse, like mind games kind of going on. And when you get into the forest, like after they escape the orphanage, almost immediately you just get a whole bunch of reveals about the world. When Emma and the group encounter the religious demons, and basically we just get like a lore dump. And that kind of, it answers a lot of questions, but it kind of like, I wish it wasn't revealed so early, because you kind of lose that allure, I guess, of the world. It's like, wow, they reveal all this. And yeah, now I have more questions. Which is always good. Like, I think it's good. A reveal is good when, like, it reveals some things, some important things, but also raises more questions to kind of keep that mystery going, right? To kind of keep you more invested. Like, okay, I've learned about this, but now I want to know about this and this. And that part is exciting, but I didn't like the fact that we just learned, like, hey, thousands of years ago, demons and humans made this promise. There is a human world free of demons, but it's, like, on the other side. And you guys right now are living in the demon world. And there's it's very difficult to get to the other side. You have to break this promise, so on and so forth. Like, a lot of stuff gets revealed. It's kind of convenient how the first like intelligent demons that they encounter happen to be religious demons that are not going to harm them. I mean, they do encounter demons in the wild before that, and then they get saved by these religious demons. But it is a little convenient how that happens, because honestly, part of the allure too was that, okay, even if they break out of this orphanage, how the heck are Emma and Ray and Don and Gilda going to keep all of these little ones safe? And they kind of partly solved that by keeping the really little kids at the orphanage, because like their group was already so big to begin with. And then you have like these kids, they're just like toddlers, right? And there's no way. So like they kind of solved that issue in, I think, a creative way where it's like, okay, we'll come back. We'll come back for these kids at the orphanage. They're not going anywhere anytime soon. They're not going to be prematurely shipped off unless they're like Connie and they're just really, I guess poor Connie, unless you're just really dumb, basically, unless you're really dumb. It's like, well, this brain is not going to grow into anything better. So we're just going to go ahead and just off her, I guess, you know? So I don't know if Emma really accounted for that. I mean, I know Phil, who's like the only standout like toddler that's left at the orphanage. I know he's like the really intelligent one. Oh my gosh, my dog won't shut up. I'm sorry, guys, if you hear her in the background. I know that he's like the really intelligent one there. So you don't have to worry about him. But and it's revealed later, there are still kids getting shipped off, which sucks. And Phil has to just kind of sit back quietly and watch them get shipped off. And I think Emma was aware that this was going to happen. So like there is sort of a sacrifice that she has to make there. Like, I can't take these kids with me. So she's kind of being realistic in that sense, because it's like, there's just no way. There's no way we can get them all to just navigate them safely through this world. But at the same time, she still has a relatively large group full of relatively young children. So I don't know how she can still maintain that idea that she's gonna be able to keep these kids alive. But yeah, so like they're traveling with a really large group, and it is convenient how they happen to slip into the shelter of these religious demons and get taken care of by them. And also they teach them how to survive and hunt and stuff like that, and more about the demons, their kind. So it's just it was a little convenient, but it was interesting, the stuff that I did learn. Again, it's not so much now, they're not so much trying to outsmart an intelligent force or an enemy, right? They're kind of just learning about the world, where they need to go, how they need to get there, what they need to do when they get there. And they're setting goals from this. They're setting goals for themselves. Jeez, I'm like stumbling over my words. I do this a lot. which is cool. Like, I like how this series has a clear sense of direction. And while the kids are navigating the world, they're just like, they're constantly hitting like these major beats. It's like, okay, so we learned about this. Now our next goal is to learn about this. And they go and do that. And then it's like, okay, now the next thing is this. So like there's these set goals, point A to point B to point C, like they're going down a certain path. And like, at first it's a lot of like hemming and hawing. It's like, well, how are we gonna be able to do this? I don't even know where to begin in this situation. But, you know, occasionally it's like a lot of time some outside force helps them, you know? So it is a little bit convenient that way. But I guess, I mean, that's the only way to do it, because otherwise they're just going to be blindly navigating this demon-infested world and they're not going to know where the heck to go, right? So I guess I understand from a storytelling perspective why that needs to be the case, why, like, they just need to, you know, as soon as they're in a rut, something comes out and helps them and then gets them, you know, basically set on their next path. So it's convenient, but I understand why it has to be that way. And honestly, I can't think of like suggestions on how I would do it differently, to be honest. So, yeah. But yeah, so they encounter these religious demons. They learn a lot about the world. It's a very different atmosphere. Now it just feels like before the orphanage, it was just like this certain tone, right? But now it just feels like, okay, now we're in like survival mode. This is like post-apocalyptic survival, that kind of thing. You know, you're in a world of it, just like these terrifying, like just the scale of these demons. I think what's really exciting is when you see like the intelligent demons that are like humanoid formed. That's like the highlight of the manga for me. When in terms of like the enemies that they encounter, because like the generic like monster rabid looking demons, it's like they were intimidating when they first showed up, but now that they learned like survival tactics and Emma knows how to like shoot a bow now and stuff like that, it does seem a little like, okay, it's just like I don't know, I guess if like in video game terms, like it's like, okay, it's just another slime, you know, just like, okay, slam, be on our way. But when there's a humanoid demons, that's when the real threat happens, you know, that kind of thing. So now it's just like at the point where I am at the end of volume 12, it's like they already pretty much know how to dispatch these rabid demons, right? There's not much of a challenge there. I mean, they've already been through a lot at that point. They've killed intelligent demons, but we'll get to that later. So I am looking at my notes here, and Yeah, I did mention how, they did reveal a lot about the world, and a pretty huge mystery that we got a pretty definite, like, solid answer to. And I was worried that would take away from the allure, but it actually creates that tangible goal I was talking about. But despite that, it still seems like the challenge is just totally insurmountable. But of course, like Emma and Ray being like the, there's like, yeah, it's gonna be difficult, but now we know what to do. And that was the main thing that they were worried about. It's like, well, now we know that there are people on our side, and now we know that there's something we can actually do. They were worried that they would be just lost in this world. They wouldn't have a safe place to get to. And that's what I like about, that's what I like about Promised Neverland, is to, like, set goals. I do realize that as I'm reading, I'm starting to realize how much of, like, a shonen protagonist Emma really is. She's just, like, constantly just idealistic in spite of, like, everything going on around her. And there are still, like, really dark things going on in behind the scenes, like Sanju, which was one of the religious demons, or I think I don't know if it was the girl or the guy, but when he or she reveals about the mass production farms, where, like, basically the real world equivalent would be, like, basically those environments where it's like, yeah, just mass production, animals just being just put in these just terrible living situations, and they're basically just being farmed for food. We do it to, like, chickens and stuff like that. It's just, like, inhumane. It's really gross. And that reveal was actually pretty dark. And just, like, seeing the look on Emma's face when Sanju explains the way that some of these humans are farmed, it's just, oof, man, it gives you the chills. So it's not like Emma's completely unfazed, but a lot of the time she just gets back on her feet really quickly. Which, I mean, isn't a bad thing. I would have liked to see more of, like, I guess, like a mental struggle. I don't want to see the character tortured. I just want to see more of, like, you're dealing with a lot here. I mean, it's exhausting, right? I want to see more of a. She just seems like she's too idealistic. I don't know. I get why that's, like, important for, like, a main character, as a main character. She hasn't really been. She's witnessed a lot, but she hasn't really, like, been broken by the things around her, so and that's again, that's fine, but also it's like, how is this character gonna grow? If you don't get her to a certain low, she's not gonna be able to grow from that, right? From the beginning, it's like how Emma and Ray were in the beginning of the series is basically where they are right now. At the end of volume 12, they're just a little older, and they, like, their skill sets have improved. But from, like, an emotional growth, I guess, it's just like you really don't see much. There a lots of things are happening, and our party's just being dragged along for the ride. And and again, like, while the main party has learned about the world and how to survive, and it doesn't really feel like they've really grown outside of, like, physically having grown, So I want to see some more, like, character to character moments in the series. I really like the characters, and I think, honestly, the highlight, which I'll get to in terms of characters, is this character that gets introduced when they get to the shelter, the geezer, which I don't know why they make it such a, like, a huge point to, like, hide his name, because there's really no significance to his name when it's actually revealed. Which, by the way, if you read up to volume 12, it's Yugo. And honestly, I think the only thing that I the only reason that they were making a big deal probably was because, like, Yugo was very untrusting. He didn't want to get attached to the children, so he didn't want to tell them his name. He wasn't even calling them by their names because he just didn't want to have that association with them in case, he loses them and he gets hurt all over again. Because, like, he's dealt with a lot. So, like, Yugo honestly is, like, the highlight of, like, this point of, like, volumes, like, I don't know when he gets introduced, to be honest, like, volume 7, I don't even know, up until volume 12. He's really the highlight for me. I really enjoy his character. And he honestly gets the most growth, I think, compared to, like, Emma Ray and Don and Gilda and the rest of the kids. You really don't see that much from them. It's kind of unfortunate. Like, there's a lot. This manga seems more focused on the moment to moment, like, I mean, like, the plot beat by plot beat, just, like, getting from point A to point B, and not so much of the stuff that's in between. You see a lot of, like, reactions from the characters when, like, bad things happen. Like, for instance, Ray gets, like, just pissed when, like, Emma gets kidnapped, and that's a very sweet moment because you realize how close they are. But at the same time, it's just like, yeah, I mean, anybody would get pissed that somebody they know and love or have treated as family for so long is suddenly in put in harm's way. I mean, a lot of that happens in the manga where, like, kids are put in danger, and then Emma and Rei get these really intense expressions, and they're just like, no, you know, I can't let them be in danger. I'm going to save them, so on and so forth. Like, it's really, that's very, like, bare bones in terms of, like, emotional depth, right? Like, yeah, you're going to get pissed if a family member of yours is in danger, or is, you know, being, somebody got killed, or somebody's being fed for, you know, to the demons or something. That's like, you know, that's about as bare bones as it gets. I want to see more, like, I don't know, character to character, like moment to moment things between the characters to show, to like kind of emphasize that relationship that they have with each other as family. I don't know. You get little bits of it, but not, I don't think enough, you know. I feel attached to these kids, but not as much as I think I could be, you know. Like, obviously, they're children. I mean, they're fictional children, but you don't want to see children just getting, you know, eaten alive by demons. I mean, nobody wants to see that. So just like from a fundamental, like, moral perspective, it's like, yeah, I don't want to see kids get eaten by demons. But at the same time, this main cast of characters, like, do I really like feel for them? If one of the kids was just to die off screen, I mean, yeah, it would suck. But like, would I feel like emotionally just bent out of shape about it? Would I like cry, you know, like that kind of thing? I'd feel for like Emma's character. It's more of like how I feel the main cast would react to like a death of like a side character than I would about that actual side character, you know. And that could be a little cold maybe from me, but I don't know, I just don't feel that sort of attachment. And I'm not ragging on this, guys, I'm just kind of going into the positives and negatives of what I've read through this little gap. So I'm kind of moving around a lot, I apologize. But so after the religious demons kind of like, you know, basically guide them along the path, I think Mujica, oh, that's right. So Sanju was the male demon. Mujica is the one that gives Emma a medallion. It's a very mysterious medallion. That's another mystery that kind of gets introduced and then kind of just guides them along their way. And it just reminds you too that with Sanju's character, like how he has like that intense expression, like why is he helping these children? He has his own selfish reasons for helping these children. He wants them to break the promise so that things can go back to the way they were, where it was like just like chaos between demons and humans, and he could just hunt for real again, you know. But they're like vegetarians because they don't, or not vegetarians, well, basically vegetarians because they don't believe in hunting, or they don't believe in you know, the way the humans are produced right now. It's very unnatural to them. They're not hunted, they're just farmed, you know, so that's why they refrain from eating humans. I think Mujica feels a little more like sympathetic as a character, a demon character, where Sanju is just clearly just like, you know, he's a demon. I mean these are demons. Again, you can't add like our human sensibilities to them. They're demons. So of course, like, all he's thinking about is hunting and being able to like just the thrill of the hunt and being able to consume just fresh human meat, you know, that kind of thing. So, but yeah, they ended up getting to this shelter. And another thing that's pointed out is like, it is convenient how they kind of get from one safe haven to safe haven. You know, there's always the impending challenges ahead that keep the stakes and the tensions high, but there's always this level of like, okay, you know, they're never put in harm's way for too long. And this is a large group of characters. So like from a writer's perspective, it's more feasible this way if these kids are stationed, these large groups of children are stationed in certain safe areas where the writer doesn't have to worry about them as much, about, you know, moving them around. Because then otherwise it'd just be too many moving parts. It'd be hard to keep track of. And again, these are children. So like, how the heck are they going to survive on their own, right? So it is a little convenient, but you know, there's still those impending challenges ahead. There's that level of mystery with each new person or demon that the kids encounter. You know, I'm always waiting for like the other shoe to drop. I'm like, I'm glad the kids aren't being like off left and right, but realistically they probably should be dying. I mean, if you think about it, but I guess if they were constantly being killed, it would kind of cheapen the deaths that do happen. And also it would just be a huge bummer. I mean, nobody wants to see children just getting killed week to week in Shonen Jump, right? Like, that's just terrible. Like, nobody wants to see that. And honestly, it would have huge ramifications for, like, Emma's character. Just, like, that whole stress that they're going about in this manga is, like, keeping everyone alive, keeping everyone alive, keeping everyone alive. So if kids were constantly getting killed, it would kind of mess Emma up. And that's what I'm talking about. Like, I don't want to see her tortured. But I would like to see something, like, higher, some sort of higher stakes. I don't know. I don't know how, like, creatively how you would navigate around that, but yeah, I would like to see some sort of stakes. And characters do get off, but again, it's like when you get to Goldie Pond, that's where the action ramps up. You do see more characters getting killed. Like, I mean, these are characters that Emma is just introduced to, so you don't really feel for them as much. It's still horrifying, but you know, but if, outside of those like initial like deaths, and I think death isn't exactly the right way to go about adding like emotional stakes and stuff like that. So I don't think that death is the answer either. It's, I don't know. I'm kind of a hypocrite. It's like I don't want him to kill all the characters, but I kind of want him to kill all the characters. You know, just like because that's what would happen. I mean, when you're dealing with this level of a threat, right? I don't know. But I think there's other ways just to establish that emotional connection between these characters. I don't know. I don't know. I think yeah, I would have to, I don't know, I'll have to think about this a little bit more maybe in the a next part. Maybe in the next episode if I do, you know, when I do a part three of The Promised Neverland. But I think after the first few deaths, like from the first season, the writer's been pretty generous about not offering any more kids, which is welcome because again, I don't want this to be like a children feast. But at the same time, I want to see some sort of. It just seems a little too convenient how they're just going from safe haven to safe haven. But yeah, so back to Hugo, who you meet at the shelter. I think, you know, I really like him. He definitely changes things up a bit. He's a little wacky when you first meet him. You can't tell if you trust him. He's a little bit of a loose cannon, and I really like that. That it's like they finally reach this shelter. So it's like again, it's the idea is like okay, they're going from safe haven, but they're also there's just constantly obstacles being thrown in their way. So like as much as they're being helped behind the scenes, and like and you know the people that encounter them also help them. They do run into problems still, you know, they still have to find their ways around certain problems, which is good, you know, because like there's that, it creates that conflict. We need that conflict. Otherwise it would just be too, it seems like it's just like smooth sailing and it's, and really that should not be the case when they're considering what they're up against, right? So, you know, then you meet this dude who like you think would be awesome. You have an adult on your side who knows about the world of demons. And initially he's not very you know, compliant. Like he's honestly very aggressive. You know, Hugo, he threatens to kill them and stuff like that. So he's a little bit of a loose cannon. And like his introduction honestly was really exciting for me. I'm like, oh my God, like this guy's crazy. And they have to like convince him to basically like give up the shelter so that they could stay there. And then also convince him to help them navigate this world to do what they got to do. It's a very tense situation. I really liked his introduction. I thought it was really strong. I really like the one scene where they threaten to blow up the shelter, and like even Hugo comments like, "What the heck is wrong with these kids? They're insane." And then the kids do look really creepy in that panel, like namely Emma, because like she has like her eyes are like vacant and she has like this really sadistic like or not sadistic like a gleeful smile as she's threatening to blow up the place. It really gives you chills, but it also kind of makes you laugh. And I think there's a point where like Hugo takes them to the armory, and I really appreciate on how. The author does factor in certain things. Obviously, these are children. Again, fighting these demons is not the go-to. Really, the on the chance that they are caught, running is better than fighting. And I think Emma makes that comment. So, like, you know, Emma and Ray are really intelligent, but they don't have superpowers. You know, stealth is really the main focus, and that makes sense for what they're up against. It doesn't make sense to just tackle these things head-on. They're just not. The demons have the advantage, no matter which way you look at it. You know, and well, except for like in terms of intelligence, at least for these wild demons. So like, I like the extra details, like when they go to the armory and they're trying to pick out weapons, and Emma doesn't want to pick out a big one because she just want to get slowed down, which makes sense. And you know, just for entertainment purposes, they're still put into positions where they're still fighting demons, but they're like running and fighting. You know, like the instance with the giant man-eater things. They which are as terrifying as they sound, man-eaters. You know, say what you want about like the weird-looking faces sometimes that the characters have. The demons are horrifying, and I think the artist, I can't remember if that was Demizu, was it Posca Demizu? I think that was the artist. That. They're horrifying. Those things are horrifying. They do a really good job. And just the scale alone are intimidating. Like you have these huge demons and these really tiny children. And then when one of those man-eater things seems bad enough, then you have like communities of demons, right? And then they'll call on each other. It's really intense. And there's ones that just travel in packs. And just, you know, the enemies that they face are not generic looking by any means. I really like the designs. I meant to comment on that earlier, but yeah, so like Hugo, he's infuriating as a character, but he's also really fun. Like even after sort of agreeing to cooperate with them, he's still not being fully cooperative. Like, at so many points, he just tries to screw them over. And Ray and Emma are aware of this. You know, they figure if he's not going to teach us anything, we're just going to have to observe him and learn for ourselves, which I think is really smart and clever. But of course, he's always scheming behind the scenes. And it's hard to tell at first whether he's going to carry out his plans of, like, sabotaging the children or if he's actually going to have, like, a change of heart. And, of course, that change of heart does come later on. But at first, it's not without Emma getting screwed over and then ending up in Goldie Pond first. But yeah, that part of the manga I really, really liked. Volume 9, I think this is around when it's happening. I think Volume 9 is extremely strong. There's lots of information revealed. I think the promise, you know, when you learn about the promise, that really laid the foundation. But then you get to learn about William Minerva in this volume. And, you know, he's a figure that's really been shrouded in mystery all of this time. And and what is revealed in Volume 9, it gives Emma and them, you know, several options, but it also introduces new challenges. So, like, I think one of the options, like, they can sneak their way through into the human world, or they can break the promise, which will start a new war, basically, between the demons and humans, which doesn't seem like the best idea. So it's like these ideas have their flaws. Like, if they sneak in, yeah, Emma and her family will get through safely. But then there's everything will just continue the way it has been. And all these children will still be being farmed, right? They don't get their second chance at life unless they do what Emma, Ray, and Norman did, and fight their way out. And honestly, they're probably not gonna get anywhere near as lucky as Emma and them did. Or they can break the promise to start a war, which also wouldn't be good. you'd like to think they'd be on the winning side, but that's not gonna necessarily be the case. They might just lose and get killed. So that's not exactly the best option either. And then they're presented with this other option that's not actually quite clear, which adds another mystery. So even when revealing tons of information, there's always these new mysteries, which I talked about earlier. So, like, it's like the ever-present how. Knowing, like they say, knowing is only half the battle, right? So it's like, okay, we know all this information, but what good does it do us if we don't know how the heck we're going to do this, right? And this is the area of the story that really got me thinking heavily about the promise. So, like, you can see why it was initiated to begin with, and it makes me wonder what I would do. To be honest, I think I'd be a coward. I'd want to maintain the peace that I had. So if I, you know, because I don't want to live in a world where I have to worry about my survival and there's demons loose. And, you know, this whole pact that they made, it feels like a decent compromise when you consider what you're up against. Like, even the fact that demons exist is terrifying enough for me to not want to challenge it. And I'm probably a terrible person, but, like, if I was living on that human half of the world and I knew that there was these freaking man-eating, just giant, terrifying demons on the other half of the world, I'd be like, you know what, I'm gonna stay as far away from that as possible. So, you know, it's you could understand why the people, the humans, and I didn't really talk about this, but, like, the humans that are trying to maintain the status quo, not, you know, not allow Emma and friends to break this promise, you can understand why they're so hellbent on making sure that they don't do that, because they want to maintain that the peace that they've enjoyed, which, like, is so, it's selfish. But at the same time, do you really want to start a war with all of, you know, demon kind again? And just, like, oh God, it's terrifying. It really is terrifying. I mean, honestly, man, it's tough. It's really tough. It's a big dilemma. Like, honestly, it's like, no, we're not going to let this happen to these kids. But then you're going to be fighting demons, and it's just going to be just a terrifying hellscape to live in. So it's like, ugh. But yeah, because the story is presented from the inside and then you have to witness all of these terrible things that the kids go through, it makes things really difficult. Cause, like, honestly, like they say, ignorance is bliss, right? So for instance, I'm privileged enough to live in the United States when I hear about some of the terrible things that happen in, like, third world countries, it's like, and, like, selfishly, it's just like, well, I'm glad it's not me. That's kind of the, you know, that's kind of like my default response to a lot of things that happen. It's like, wow, that's absolutely horrendous, but I'm glad that's not me. Like, and honestly, if people are being honest with themselves, I think they share a similar sentiment, right? Like, you hear just, like, these just terrible stuff going on, and you're just like, wow. Or, like, you know, there's a natural disaster in another part of the, like, this, like, on the other side of the U.S., right? Like, I'm on the east side, so, like something's going on in California, and there's, like, an earthquake or something. I'm like, holy crap, that's terrible, but I'm glad I don't live in California right now. You know, that kind of thing. Or, like, when those fires are breaking out, you know, it's like, oh, thank God that, you know, or it's just, or, like, the hurricanes that were going on in Florida, I'm like, wow, I'm glad I am not that far down south. Like that kind of idea. And I really feel like this makes me sound like a terrible person. I promise. I hope I'm not a terrible. I hope you guys don't think any less of me by saying this. But like, it's really that perspective. It's like you're not physically there. Maybe you don't have loved ones that are there. So it's just like, well, that's absolutely horrible. I'm glad that I'm safe. You know, it makes you really appreciate the overall peace that you get to enjoy when you're not put in that situation. So that's the same idea here. You know, you probably have these humans on the other side that are just like, well, maybe they're not totally aware of what's going on. You know, there's kids I'm sure that have just grown up in this lifestyle, not even knowing anything about the demons. But then there's people that do, and they're just like, well, you know, they don't want to jeopardize their peace. So, I mean, granted, there were people that were a lot more brave and selfless that, you know, want to rise up against this promise and break it. You know, the supporters, you know, basically they refer to as traitors and all that. They are the real MVPs. Like I'm not gonna pretend I'm as brave as them. So like, yeah, just thinking about the promise just it made me really think about what I would do in that situation. And that's what I would do. I would just be like, you know, I'm enjoying my peace. Like it's really selfish, but yeah, and it's really terrible of me. But I mean, to be realistic, yeah, I mean, that's what would happen. But back to Goldie Pond, I think the arc was really action heavy. The pace definitely ramps up where the kids are staging that counterattack on these demons. And it all leads to basically like a final standoff with Luvis or how you pronounce that, because he's extremely quick and he's the most competent of all the demons. He's also like insane. So there's a bit of a wild card factor. I do like Luvis, but I think he is a little tropey. Like he has a really cool design, but like he has that motivation that we've definitely seen before. It's like, oh, I'm looking for a challenge. Something needs to excite me. Just make me feel alive again, you know, like that kind of thing. I immediately think of like Hisoka from Hunter x Hunter, and honestly, I like Hisoka way more than Luvis. He feels a little derivative. And he doesn't have the same, like, I guess, like charm that like Hisoka has, as weird as that sounds, because Hisoka's kind of a problematic to put it lightly, I guess. I don't even like using that term, but he really is. Anyways, and Luvis even has this line where like I think he kills some kids like right in front of Emma, and then he's like, he says he did it to spite Emma, to like fuel her hatred, right? And like where have you seen that line? Like, not, you know, Sasuke and Itachi, you know, like fuel your hatred and then come back for me, you know, that kind of thing. It's just you know. And Itachi's motivations are way more complex. So it's like, his character's deriving from like Hisoka and Itachi, but he's not as complex as those characters. And mainly because you don't have as much time with him as you do with those characters. And also it's like, you know, they don't stick around. He doesn't stick around long. So, I think his design's really cool. And I think he gets a lot of really good close-up panels and like full body shots where you get to see him bob and weave through like just like waves of bullets, like Matrix style. And then he just deflects bullets with like his weird claw hand things. But yeah, the action's really sweet. There's this really good horizontal spread of him where I think he's on one side of the hallway, and I remember like a couple characters were shooting from the other side. I thought that was really cool. I think it was like Ray and Emma and one of the other new characters, Nigel. Yeah, that was really cool. So, you know, there's some decent, like, really dynamic, like, fluid action. I think the final strategy that they used to beat him started off really cool with, like, the flash bombing and the electrocution. That was cool. And then they discover a limit to his regeneration ability. And then the strategy basically devolves into, like, okay, we're going to spray him with bullets faster than he could regenerate. Which I feel like I just watched something. There was something I just watched or read that was the exact same strategy. It's like, okay, they can regenerate, so we'll just kill him faster than he could regenerate. And I can't remember what it was. But yeah, it was pretty tense. Though, because like they had a timer, they had a time clock, they had to do it before the effects of the flash bomb wore off. So there was like a bit of tension there, but otherwise, you know, because otherwise he'd just be dodging and catching bullets like nobody's business. So in the end, it was basically a second cloaked flash bomb that did him in. But you know, it was still pretty satisfying, I think, as like the climax of the fight. But yeah, it's kind of weird how much the manga has changed. I don't know. I mean, due to the nature of the enemy that they're going against in the arc, I mean, action was inevitable, but like, it just feels way more action heavy than I thought. Like in the earlier arc, right, it was more of like a mental, like a strategic kind of thing. And granted, there's strategy here, but like, it's, the strategy doesn't feel as well thought out, you know, well planned. So it wasn't as exciting, like as gratifying for me personally, but I can see how like people were like, oh my God, this is so cool. Like Luffy is so cool. And, you know, but I mean, maybe if I'm a younger crowd, I guess, I don't know. But yeah, I remember catching glimpses of like the future manga covers in the past before I got as far as I am now, and just like seeing Emma holding a gun. And I was like, wow, like Emma's holding a gun on that cover. I'm like, what is this, you know, what is this manga going to become? And, you know, I do enjoy the demons versus humans narrative, but it feels less inspired than the earlier stuff. And yeah, it was definitely more thrilling when the demons were more of a mystery. Now they're just kind of commonplace, right? And granted, there's still some mystery available, but like it doesn't feel as, it's not as exciting. Or I think in contrast, something like Attack on Titan, I love that series, despite whatever political narrative issues it might have or whatever, you know. Or the, you know, I don't know, I don't want to speak for the author and artist of that series, but I think that in terms of just like from a storytelling perspective and just like pure entertainment value, I think that that series did a really good job about keeping the Titans a mystery in the origins and for a long time. And to the point where people were like kind of frustrated. It's like, okay, we're getting more questions than answers, but I love that. I love that. I love just like, okay, it drip feeds you some information and then it just like freaking drops a bomb of like new mystery on you. And you're like, what the heck? Like, I really want answers, but like, that's what keeps you invested. I mean, some people, it might turn them off. It might turn them away. Like, you know, this is frustrating. I want answers now. And granted, if you want answers, you can just, I mean, if at this point, depending on where you are in the series, like if you just started Attack on Titan now, if you really want answers, you could just read them. You could just spoil yourself. But me, I like sitting and waiting and just seeing how things come into play. And then like just, it adds like a rewatchability or rereadability value to it that I'm not really feeling here with Promised Neverland. I think if I went to reread it, I would just kind of feel like, I don't know. There's not much like foreshadowing, I don't think, in this series as there is in like something like Attack on Titan. It's kind of just like, it feels a little like by the numbers kind of thing. But yeah, it was definitely more thrilling when the demons were more of a mystery. Now it's like, okay, now we know what's going on. And we basically have the entire history spelled out for us. So, I did like the aftermath of Goldie Pond. I think the emotions were really high and, it didn't feel like they were out of the clear just yet. Right. And all the fighting wasn't without some like serious incapacitating like injuries. I do think it was a cop out that not at least a couple of like the major side characters died. But, you know, I think, you know, most of them survived, though everyone was still in rough shape. I mean, they had a plan, but then the way they hyped up Luis, it just felt like, and the disadvantage that they had at first, it just felt like, I think, you know, more should have happened, like more, something more substantial should have happened to at least a couple of the kids. I mean, you introduced a decent amount of characters, but I'm glad everyone's still alive. It just feels, you know. It's that weird conflict. It's like, well, I don't want these characters to die, but also, I mean, come on, based on what they were going up against and the disadvantage that they had, like, how did at least one person, you know, like, come on. But one thing I mentioned earlier about, like, one thing I like about The Promised Neverland is that it finds clever ways to manage and manage, like, large groups of characters because Kayu Shirai, they are introducing a lot of characters. And, you know, sometimes, unless you're like Oda from One Piece, it's hard to manage all of those characters. And then like, and that's part of the issue is just like, that's why I'm not falling in love with these characters as much as I'd hoped, because like, you're not getting a lot of time with them. And also they're just going through a lot. They don't have the time to just like, there's no slice of life episodes of The Promised Neverland, you know, or chapters, right? So you're not getting a lot of time with them. They're just constantly focused on the threat that they're faced, you know, with. Occasionally you get just little moments of like the kids at the shelter eating a meal together, sharing a meal together, or like, you know, Emma putting everyone to bed, or, you know, that kind of thing. But I do like how the author manages these groups of characters, because, you know, it navigates them through this really dangerous world. So, like, you've got the youngest kids behind at the orphanage. You've got the minor characters at the shelter, Don and Gilda, and them. And now this whole Goldie Pond group. It's just a lot of characters, and it's a decent bit to keep track of, right? And again, in this demon-infested world, it would be impossible to navigate without a good chunk of, like, casualties. So, yeah, I really did expect a lot of, like, the minor characters died off, not only because it would make sense given the world, danger of the world, but also from a writing perspective, it's a lot easier to manage, right? That's a nice, it's a nice cop-out. It's like, well, I introduced these characters, they serve their purpose, I can kill them off and not have to worry about developing them anymore, right? And it's kind of like a blunt way to put it, but it's true, right? Like, from a writing perspective, the less people you have to worry about, you know, the easier it is to write, I would think, right? But there are some ramifications for our main characters, and I don't think anyone really wants to see, you know, Emma's nature be abused so aggressively by just killing off significant members of her family. Again, this whole idea I was talking about earlier, just like, we don't want to, I think the series would get too dark if that was the case. And I think it would conflict with some of the core messages that the series is trying to stick to. So it's a very shonen thing of keeping everyone alive no matter the cost, brute forcing through obstacles together, despite the odds, that sort of thing. But what I really want to see, again, I mentioned earlier, is just more character moments. I think Goldie Pond was, there's a lot of action, so characters didn't have a lot of time to breathe. But even now, it's like, where it ends off, like, now they're on down the road again, basically. So, you know, a lot of, they say, like, people grow through, they grow faster through, like, struggles, like, mutual struggle. They kind of bond faster. So I would like to see more of that. Our party's really just being dragged along for the ride. And the main cast have learned some things about the world and how to survive, but it doesn't feel like they've grown, you know. So I'm just trying to think. I don't want to repeat myself too much. I really liked Lucas and Hugo's reunion. I think that was really powerful. And I'm automatically falling in love with these characters. I don't even know why. I don't know what makes them stand out compared to the other characters. But I think this is what I'm talking about when it comes to, like, character-to-character moments. You can tell these guys had a history together and that they're just really close, you know, and they've been through a lot. Mainly because it's in the text. Like, okay, they literally watched their friends die and, like, and then they were separated for so long. So, you know. But, yeah, I think it was a really powerful moment when they were reunited. Let's see. There was the scenes with Norman. It's weird. I went through all this time without talking about Norman, but honestly, Norman, he's just kind of off doing his own thing. As much as I loved him in that first, like, arc, he's just, right now, he's kind of a non-character. I don't know what they're going to do with his character. I have no idea. There's a couple things going on behind the scenes. I'm curious to see how things progress, but, like, Norman's just doing something. He's like, he's being tested. He's probably trying to figure out a way to escape. I don't know what's going on here. And, but I do like the mystery. And then there's Phil back at the orphanage. It's heartbreaking. I love Phil. He's so cute. But, like, it's heartbreaking because he knows the truth of the orphanage and he just has to watch all these, like, newer kids just be shipped off. Like, goodbye. It's really emotional. I didn't think they would do much with his character, but I feel like he's going to be really important in the future. So, volume 11, we get a lot of info dumped on us. You know, again, more scenes from Phil. Seems like there's this, the group of people that know that Phil. It seemed to imply that they know that Phil knows what's going on and they're probably going to question him or something. I'm not sure. And there's also the mystery of that medallion that Mujica, the female religious demon that she gave to Emma. I guess it allows her to see, like, visions of the past. I remember they were looking at the, I think Emma, like, was looking at some sort of, she was, like, studying some sort of engraving on some old ruins that they had visited. I think it was, like, 2 months after Goldie Pond. And, also, 2 months, like, I wish we saw some of that 2 months. I feel like this series is going, like, at a breakneck pace, and I wish it would slow down. Like, that 2 months where they were, what were they doing, you know? I wanted to see a little bit of that. But the series does a couple time skips. So 2 months after Goldie Pond, they go investigate these ruins, and then there's a lot going on. It's kind of hard to remember. But I think it's interesting how William Minerva gave them several paths to choose, but, of course, Emma's going to pick the path that's the hardest, right? It's going to put them in the most danger. But it's respectable, you know. That's what I like about a character, and also what I find kind of infuriating about a character. But there's the mystery of the seven walls, some person that they have to make a new promise with. There's also like the supporters of William Minerva hiding around somewhere helping the kids behind the scenes. And then you have that year and 7th month time skip, which was kind of shocking to me because I'm like, a year and 7 months, that's a lot of time that they just jumped. And it brings us super close to that allotted time frame that they had where they were going to return back to the orphanage. So like, I'm kind of shocked that the series is moving this fast. It almost feels like it's going to end. And granted, I know in the Shonen Jump app, compared to where I left off here in volume 12, which is like chapter 106, right? There's like 130-something chapters, 150-something. I can't remember in the Shonen Jump app. So like, I almost wonder, like, I don't know how much more they're going to introduce before like the series ends. It feels like it's wrapping up. I don't know. I don't know. We'll see. I was going to say, if it wraps up now, I don't think I'll be very satisfied. But again, I have like probably like 50 chapters worth of material to read to fully catch up. And then there's however much more after that. But yeah, I really like the time skipped. I thought it was kind of just like shocking. Because I like seeing the characters' designs change a little bit. And, you know, they're getting older. It's also great from like a story perspective because it makes the young ones that were traveling with Emma and them a little more capable. So you can do more with those characters, hopefully. But yeah, they find a temple, I think, that they were looking for, and then like some sort of golden water, which I forget the significance of. But I guess it's going to bring them closer to finding the seven walls, which seems like their main goal right now. And yeah, that's a pretty big time crunch because they only have 2 months. So, and I'm just trying to remember, I think where it left off, the shelter was being infiltrated, which I thought was a really powerful moment. And there was actually a scene with Emma, I think, yelling at one of the dudes that I think his name's Andrew or something. He wears glasses, and he was like in charge of this infiltration on their base. And she's like, you know, why are you guys doing this? Like, we want to live too. Like, and then like she shocked him when she revealed she knew about like the promise and all that stuff. And then she even gave him, like, told him what their intentions were. And I kind of wanted to see a little bit more, like, humanity from this Andrew guy. I think his name's Andrew. I hope I'm not getting it wrong. But, like, he's just like, well, doesn't matter either way. We still have to kill you or something like that. And so that kind of felt kind of, like, I felt kind of lame. Like, he's always, like, he's a villain. Like, he's not mustache-twirling villain, but it's like, you know, this is my job I'm doing, and I'm going to carry it out. It's just his personality. There's really no humanity there. I mean, yeah, I mean, they're just gonna murder all these kids. Thankfully, they escape, and I think that's where like the volume 12 leaves off. So, yeah, I'm excited for what's to come. I have no idea. I'm really falling in love with again Yugo and Lucas, but I don't think they. I'm not sure what their what the future holds for them. It doesn't seem like they're in a good position. So, yeah, that pretty much leaves off. Everything I need to cover for this catch up. That was like 6 volumes worth of material or 7. I don't even know. So yeah, the next follow up episode of The Promised Neverland, I'm gonna do like a part 3. It's not gonna be as wide of a gap as I mentioned. I think at the introduction of the episode, I'm going to probably wait till like 3. I think a volume releases this month, and then I'm probably gonna wait till a couple more release and read those, and then do a part 3 sometime later this year. But yeah, the next episode is going to be Land of the Lustrous. I think I had promised to do that before I went on break. And then, I guess Yone of the Dawn. Oh, well, you know, maybe just switch it. I'll do Land of the Lustrous, Inuyashiki, and then Yone of the Dawn part 2, which should be fun. And, yeah, if you guys enjoyed this format, I think I would recommend reading like the first 6 or 7 volumes of, Yone of the Dawn. If you happen to have picked it up, when I had introduced it a while back, I don't know. I'm not expecting you guys to have like as much, you know, expendable income to just drop money on 7 volumes of a series, but that's probably where we're going to end up covering like up to volume 6 or 7 of Yone of the Dawn on that part 2 episode. So you have time before I actually get to it. But yeah, thank you guys for being patient. Again, this is, this ending segment here, where I started talking about Goldie Pond, this is Present John speaking. I had to actually finish this episode. I didn't finish it over my break. So yeah, I'm actually pretty happy with how this came through. It's going to be a really long episode. I guess that might just be the, you know, this might be the exception because I don't think the next ones are going to be as long because it won't be as much material to talk about. I feel like I came off pretty hard on the series, I think. I don't know. I am enjoying the series. It's not my favorite thing running in Shonen Jump right now. I think that's probably reserved for Chainsaw Man. But I also started reading My Hero Academia because, like, I'm kind of disappointed with the season for some reason. I don't know. As much as I love Mirio, he's like one of my favorite characters. Lemillion, if you guys are familiar with his hero name. As much as I love him, it's just weird. I don't know what it is about the season that I just don't like. And I read up on it. I think it's a change of director or something. Anyways, I don't want to go off on a tangent. But yeah, I started reading My Hero Academia, which I'm really enjoying the manga. I'm glad I switched to it. So the art's just so much better. I mean, Bones is doing a great job adapting it, but the art's just so good. That'll do it for this episode. And I'll catch you guys next week, hopefully, if everything goes according to schedule. All right, you guys have a good one.